You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, to be austere or not to be austere? That is still the question on the lips of European leaders. They've gathered in Brussels today. We'll find out if they've found any answers. Also coming up, the new spiritual leader of a billion Catholics is from Argentina. We'll find out what the appointment will do for the international image of the homeland of Pope Francis.
Jorge Bergoglio, Francis is going to be a great pope, I hope for that. And of course this is going to help the image of Argentina.
A bit later I'll be checking in with our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé, he's in Berlin. We'll be talking Lufthansa's strategy and the German media machine. We'll also be in Cannes for the closing day of the MIPIM gathering, finding out what's inside the heads of global architecture's big thinkers.
I really believe in synergy between, of course, developers and architects, but as much also other fields of industries to enrich architecture and the built environment.
All that plus we find out why the scientists in CERN may know a lot about particle physics, but they've got a lot to learn about typefaces. All of that still to come in the next hour here on Midori House. . 1801 here in London. Let's have a roundup of the headlines to start us off. Here's David Spencer.
Pope Francis I has sounded a warning to the Catholic Church at his first Sistine Chapel Mass with cardinals as Pope. He said the Church would become what he called a compassionate NGO without spiritual renewal. Pope Francis has also started the process of appointing key staff at the Vatican. Michael Severance from the religious think tank Action Institute met the new pope days before he was named as cardinal 12 years ago in Rome and was impressed.
When he took questions, he often stared down at his feet like this and listened very intently, rubbing his brow. You could see he took in every word, every syllable that the students had asked. And I was thinking to myself, what a great man. For sure, he has the virtue of empathy. He listens to people, he takes things into context, he rehashes it in his mind, and he gives a balanced perspective. And I think we'll have that as a pope. You'll find him to be the great listener.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to announce a new government after clinching key deals to form a coalition 2 months after the election. In control of 68 of Parliament's 120 seats, the right-wing leader's new administration is expected to take office next week, just days before a visit by US President Barack Obama. France's Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius says France and Britain want an urgent European Union meeting to persuade their allies to lift the Syria arms embargo. Fabius warned that Paris could break the embargo as the situation worsens. The embargo will lapse on May the 31st unless all 27 EU states agree to renew it. UK Foreign Secretary William Hague agrees the situation might need to change.
We've no plans at the moment to do anything different from what I've announced in Parliament last week. That was to give that additional non-lethal support as well as training, advice and assistance. I have said, of course, that that policy may need to change again in the future if the situation continues to get worse, more people dying, more people fleeing.
Brazilian dock workers have postponed a 24-hour nationwide strike planned for next week to allow more time for negotiations. The workers are unhappy at a proposed overhaul of Brazil's 1993 port regulations, fearing it will lead to a loss of jobs and benefits. Unions have agreed to continue talks but have not ruled out future strikes. Scientists who last summer triumphantly announced the discovery of a new particle but held back from saying what it was have declared there is now little doubt it was the long-sought Higgs boson. Latest analysis of data from the Large Hadron Collider particle accelerator strongly indicates it is the Higgs, say the physicists. The boson was spotted as a bump on a graph early in 2012. Physicists believe the boson is linked to the vital formation of the universe after the Big Bang. Swiss International Airlines, part of the Lufthansa Group, has announced a 31% fall in operating profits to 212 million Swiss francs. However, figures for the last quarter of 2012 were an improvement on the previous year at 27 million Swiss francs. The airlines also announced it's phasing out its Airbus A340 fleet from 2016, and orders have been placed with Boeing for 6 777-300ERs. Meanwhile, Airbus has delivered its 1,000th A380 to Malaysia Airlines in Toulouse. It's the airline's 6th A380. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Leaders from across Europe have left their respective capitals today to gather in Brussels to discuss whether to continue tough austerity measures or to give a little slack. Southern European countries have, of course, been struggling with record high unemployment, stagnant growth, and the angry mobs of protesters that tend to follow, while Northern European countries, led by Angela Merkel, have been cracking the whip of austerity, insisting that spending is curbed, deficits are cut. Well, Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson is in Brussels for us. Before we speak to her, let's head to Spain and to Italy to get a sense of how people are hurting there. Joining us on the line is Liam Aldous in Madrid and Ivan Carvalho in Milan. Liam, let's start with you. A sort of interminable recession. The government owns three banks now. Record levels of youth unemployment. How does the average Spaniard feel at the moment?
Well, not too good. They're not very chirpy, I can tell you that. And if you look at the data as well, you can see that the Spanish economy has shrunk for six consecutive quarters, and the prospects just don't look good. And unemployment is a huge problem. We've got a national rate of 26%. Youth unemployment is huge. It's 55%. They're the official numbers anyway. We don't know what's happening in the other underground economy, but the prospects aren't looking good. So while the government has actually made a lot of structural reforms, they're not bearing fruit in the short term. So I think we're going to see the Spanish delegation really arguing for a little bit of leeway. They really want some measures to promote youth unemployment at least.
And is there a sense that with these enormously high levels of youth unemployment, for example, there's something of a disengagement from the political process as a result?
Perhaps, but I mean, yeah, I think because the government has had to take a lot of these measures in the first term of the first year of their term, they haven't really been trying to win any hearts and minds. But now there was actually a hint of improvement, maybe with the relationship with the youth and the government in the State of the Union address that Rajoy gave in January, saying that he was going to maybe make some exceptions for social security payments for employers who are willing to employ people under 30. So there are hints of some change. So maybe we'll see some new policies, not just some cutbacks, but some actual policies to promote economic growth and job growth.
Liam, thank you very much for that snapshot. We're going to go to Ivan in Italy now. Ivan, some pretty grim Q4 figures released today. That's to add to the political instability. How's everyone feeling where you are?
Well, Italy is right now in the longest post-war recession, and it's quite bad. The unemployment level is, we're almost at 3 million now unemployed. And for 2013, it looks like there'll be negative growth again. So there's no light at the end of the tunnel, it seems.
And what's the level of interest in what's going on in Brussels at the moment? Obviously, this has enormous ramifications potentially for the average Italian. Are they keeping an eye on it?
Yeah, there's definitely concern. Mario Monti, you know, is when he's going to be talking with the leaders, is going to mention the fact that right now the populism in Italy, because of the recent election and the fact that 8.5 million votes went to Beppe Grillo, and he has in his platform there's the talk about this referendum on the euro, and he made comments recently to a German financial paper saying, well, Italy is sort of already de facto out of the euro. So when you're at meeting in Brussels, that's not a great thing if you're the prime minister, even though, of course, Mario Monti is the outgoing prime minister. And there should also be concern because, you know, a lot of voters backed Silvio Berlusconi, who also had in his platform some anti-EU, anti-Euro rhetoric. I mean, some people thought, well, maybe it was sort of in the heat of the moment of the campaign, but, you know, there's definitely cause for concern because of the austerity measures that a lot of people think were pushed on Italy through Mario Monti because he was sort of seen as someone that Berlin and Brussels were backing. I mean, for example, Martin Schulz, who's the head of the EU Parliament, was before the election was in Sicily saying, you know, Berlusconi was not, you know, a credible candidate. And so now, of course, but we have this outcome where we still have to decide on Italy still has to decide on who's going to be running the Parliament, or they may actually have to go back to vote in June. So right now, there's a lot of instability. So, you know, concern with Europe is something where voters may feel, well, you know, we need to take care of our national interests first. So maybe we need to step off the austerity button.
Ivan, thanks very much. Let's head over to Brussels now, where we're joined by Monocle regular Charlotte McDonald-Gibson. Hello, Charlotte. Give us the headlines. What's come out of this talking shop so far?
Well, the leaders started arriving a couple of hours ago, and they were greeted by thousands of protesters who were outside saying that these austerity measures are not dragging Europe back to prosperity, but rather condemning millions to hardship and unemployment. And that discussion is very much, that debate is very much mirrored at the summit today with France and other southern European nations very much leading the push to soften the language on austerity. But they're facing Angela Merkel, who is keen to continue down the path of austerity. So it's a case at the moment of waiting and seeing. There's a communique expected later on this evening to see if that language is softened, to see if there's any give on the deficit cutting targets for some of these countries.
I guess in order for that language to be softenable, if that's a word, then, you know, these gatherings are often quite good for the sort of temperature taking of how the international community's feeling. In order for things to be softened, really, we need to have a sense of being over the worst. Are we likely to get a sense of being over the worst?
Well, certainly the leaders of the European institution, the leader of the president of the European Commission, Josep Barroso, he frequently gives statements saying that things are getting better, we are getting over the worst, but then we have these unemployment figures that come out and they, you know, they feel they give a sense of a real sort of depression in European nations. I think the real issue recently that's seen a turning point or seen a shift in the discussion and the debate is the Italian elections, because countries have had to wake up to the fact that, hang on a second, these austerity measures, they may well be punished at the ballot box. However, for Angela Merkel, it's almost the opposite, because she's facing elections in September, and the German electorate are very keen not to see their taxes go to struggling Eurozone nations. So she's got a different balance, where she has to be seen not to be backing away from these very harsh austerity policies.
I mean, a lot of statements come out just before and at the beginning of these sorts of gatherings with people sort of setting out their stall. Herman Van Rompuy has emphasised that he's effectively sort of said that the healing process takes time, and that even if these group of nations has turned the corner, we might not see any results. I mean, is there a sense that statements like that are aimed somewhere? Who's that sort of statement for? Is that for China? Is that for the US to sort of calm potentially jangled investor nerves?
Well, certainly. I mean, everything that's said is taking the markets into account. There doesn't want to be any panic. They don't want any panic, and there's no need for that either, because there are positive signs of growth, and the deficits are improving. Those messages just aren't really getting through to the people. So, I mean, Martin Schulz, the president of the European Parliament, he made that quite clear in his comments to the council this evening, when he told people that they must look at the outcome of the Italian elections. He says that our policies are offensive to many people's sense of social justice. So I think the real struggle for the leaders of the European Union and for the individual national leaders is to somehow get that message across to the people, who are just, frankly, angry at the moment.
I mean, how difficult is the sort of gulf, the political gulf that exists between North and South? I mean, I alluded to it in the intro there, but I mean, we've got a political process like Beppe Grillo getting as many votes as he has in Italy, and it contrasts so strongly with what's going on in Northern Europe. Is there a sense that it's sort of two opposite sides here, and there's going to be a real difficulty to find common ground in 2 short days?
Well, I don't think it's intractable, and these are discussions that have been going on for a while. So I don't think either side of the debate, the pro-austerity, the anti-austerity, are really in the mood at the moment for a real battle over these issues. This is a point in time where they're looking at the policies, how they're working. So I think they will come to some agreement that they will all be happy with at the end of the day.
Charlotte, we will leave it there. Monocle's Charlotte McDonald Gibson in Brussels, thank you for joining us. Before Charlotte, we heard from Liam Aldous, our man in Spain, and Ivan Carvalho giving the picture from Italy too. Coming up, we look back at the legacy of Yeng Sari, the former Khmer Rouge leader.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
It's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances as the last record, so it's always going to be quite different.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
The main market used to be Europe, of course, United States and Japan. Now you have tens of market, very interesting, also regions. You have, of course, Russia, then you have Kazakhstan, you have so many other. It's a completely different world.
What could be greater than an hour of The Curator? Listen to it live or download it later.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Sixteen minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House. Now, the former senior Khmer Rouge leader Yeng Sari has died today, aged 87. Sari was one of three elderly leaders on trial for genocide, crimes against humanity and war crimes committed under the 75 to 79 Maoist regime. As foreign minister, Sari was responsible for convincing many educated Cambodians who'd fled the Khmer Rouge to return to help rebuild the country. Many were then tortured and executed as part of the purge of intellectuals. Well, earlier today, our news editor Tom Edwards spoke to Monocle's Guy Delaunay, who lived and worked in Phnom Penh for 8 years, reporting on this subject.
Tell me, what will be the reaction, do you think, in Cambodia? Will there be a real sense of being robbed of an opportunity to see some justice here because of his death while he was still on trial?
Yes, absolutely. People all the time, especially at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, talk about this idea of timely justice. Well, there's nothing very timely about this at all, is there? The man left power of the Khmer Rouge government in 1979. It took until 2007 to arrest him. Well, that was 5.5 years ago, November 2007, that he was arrested. Why on earth is he still on trial at this point? Why is the trial not being completed? Especially bearing in mind the Khmer Rouge Tribunal was meant to start in 2006 and be finished within 3 years. I think people are staggered and they will feel definitely cheated by this. And it's interesting, Tom, you talked of Yeng Sari going abroad and persuading intellectual Cambodians to come back to the country. Well, my landlord, while I lived in Phnom Penh for 8 years, was one of those people, and he was extremely bitter about the fact that these people were being treated, as he said it, much better than they treated the Cambodian people. They had very comfortable quarters in their detention centre at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. That was bad enough for him. The fact now that he's died without receiving justice would be traumatic, I would have thought, for many people who lived through those times.
Tell me a little more, Guy, about this man, Yeng Sari. I gather, you know, you were fairly sort of closely acquainted with him at the time of his arrest back in 2007, as you mentioned. What kind of man was this? What was the character of the man? And what was it about him that was, I mean, obviously the regime and its brutality is well documented. What was Sari's kind of role and how did his character fit into that bigger picture?
Well, they're slippery people, the Khmer Rouge, in many ways. You mentioned the time of his arrest. Well, indeed, I was actually standing outside his house when he was arrested in 2007. And this was a large house. You'll see news reports describing it as a luxury villa in Phnom Penh. Well, I wouldn't perhaps go quite that far, but it was certainly a very comfortable building in a quiet street in the city centre. Extremely comfortable, nothing like the conditions of the Khmer Rouge that people had to suffer under the Khmer Rouge regime. Now, the question is, why did a man who believed in revolution, who had all these Maoist ideas. Why was he living in this way, which was very different to the way the rest of the people in Cambodia were living, even in 2007, when most people still living very simply in the countryside? Why would he live in comparative luxury in the city? Why was there a Buddhist stupa ready for him in the nearby pagoda when, under the Khmer Rouge regime, religion was in effect banned and Buddhist monks were among the worst persecuted at the time? Ieng Sary was one of the intellectual leaders of the Khmer Rouge. He was one of the clique who were in Paris in the 1950s studying, getting these revolutionary ideas that were around at the time, brought them back to Cambodia and implemented them in the most horrific way you can possibly imagine. But was there any depth to them? That's what people will be asking, I imagine, bearing in mind the kind of life that he lived after the Khmer Rouge surrendered in the late 1990s.
Now, Guy, another thing people will be asking is, where is this justice then? These other defendants who, I think some are still on trial, there have been one or two convictions. What's the kind of track record of these prosecutions, and why is it that they're having such a problem? Why has it been such a long, drawn-out saga? Are there vested interests? Well, what do you think is the reasons behind this very frustrating delay and system that we've seen?
It's incredible, isn't it? The judges were sworn in July 2006, so it's almost 7 years. We've had in that time one conviction of Comrade Doik, who was a prison chief of one of the most notorious Khmer Rouge prisons, who was already in custody. He'd already been in custody since 1999, and he, in effect, was pleading guilty, so it was an easy hit. Why on earth has it taken 7 years to do this? And especially when they said it would only take 3 years. Well, the prosecutors today have been saying, well, there are a lot of articles in the indictment. We needed to go into every single one, prove every single piece of evidence. It clearly, really, bearing in mind the age of the defendants, the age of many of the Khmer Rouge victims, the gap between the time the offences were committed and the present day, it's the wrong process. Going into this international criminal justice process was not the right thing. I think that's been proven now, and I think many people would feel exactly the same way. It doesn't help the people of Cambodia to put these people on trial and have them die before a verdict is reached, or in the case of Ieng Sary's wife, Ieng Thirit, she was discharged because she was suffering from dementia. And this isn't any kind of justice for anyone at all. And the problem is, people see a nice international criminal tribunal coming their way and they'll think they'll get a high standard of justice. I think they're finding out these processes have many problems in their own right. And in this case, it's fallen right into the middle of them.
That was Guy Delaunay speaking to Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards on the legacy of former senior Khmer Rouge leader Ieng Sary. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Today with me, Dominic Reynolds. Up next, we'll talk brand Argentina and how a pope might have changed it. But to get us there, here's Tulipa Ruiz with Aki. Tulipa Ruiz with Aki there. But now from Brazil, we're heading to Argentina. Ladies and gentlemen of the Catholic world, your new spiritual leader is from Argentina. That isn't how Pope Francis was introduced to the world yesterday evening, of course, but in the frantic global media scrum for information that followed the announcement, his home country was just one of the only things the world had to go on. So now that the cleric, formerly known as Jorge Bergoglio, is moving from Buenos Aires to Vatican City, is the international perception of his homeland going to change? Earlier, I spoke about brand Argentina with Rodolfo Milesi, who's founder of Branding Latin America. Rodolfo, everybody waited and they heard the word Argentina or Argentina. How do you think internationally people's perceptions at the moment, what do you think people's perceptions at the moment are of Argentina?
If we are talking as a generic international perception, Argentina has a great image, especially from the cultural point of view, arts, sports. We have 4 Nobel Prizes. You go to Buenos Aires and you are immersed in a lot of culture. From the investment and economic point of view, yes, we have had ups and downs, but I would like to highlight that we had a big crisis 12 years ago, maybe 11 years ago, but a rapid recovery. Now we are suffering a little bit, but this is, I think, not affecting the image and the perception of Argentina. People, well, when they travel to Buenos Aires, when they travel to Patagonia, Iguazu Falls, Mendoza, they love Argentina.
And those are huge international icons, of course. The financial problems that you alluded to there, do you think that Argentina's had a sort of confidence crisis as a result of this? So much of branding is tied up with confidence and projection and that sort of thing. Do you think that there's been some damage in that area?
I think this news about to have an Argentine pop is, yes, is going to help in some way the confidence of Argentines and maybe the general perception of the country. I think Jorge Bergoglio, Francis, is going to be a great pope. I hope for that. And of course, this is going to help the image of Argentina.
The little we've heard of him thus far, or at least this is what the media has evinced from his little speech yesterday. He's humble. He's relatively down to earth. He's got vision. Are those character traits that can be transferred onto his homeland effectively?
Yes, I know all those characteristics. He was a very approachable archbishop in Buenos Aires. Also, he's famous for going to the churches by bus. So he was a very popular archbishop. But also, I would say, a part of being a simple man, charismatic, which is fine, I would say that he has a lot of character and he has political views very, very strong, and he's an intellectual. He's a Jesuit. So I believe that it's a mix of two great things, simplicity but also character.
And you think that's a good match for the pre-existing qualities of Brand Argentina?
Yes, because I think the people that belongs to the Catholic Church needs a little bit of more charisma, needs a little bit of Argentina in a way. So I really hope that the Pope could be closer to the people. And I think next week we are going to see millions of people in the Vatican.
Talking more broadly about the, I guess, the journey Argentina has been on over the last two decades, you alluded to the financial problems. It seems that while we've been talking about that sort of thing in relation to Argentina, we've been talking about its neighbour, Brazil, in opposite terms, about stratospheric growth, at least initially, perhaps less so recently. When you're talking about nation branding, do you have to react to that sort of thing? Does nation branding have to be reactive? Does Argentina have to define itself differently now that Brazil has this particular perception?
To be honest, I think this is more a local thing between Brazilians and Argentines. I have to say that in my Facebook, there were a lot of ironies and comments, funny posts, but not aggressive and not post where you can feel that the Brazilians were like, I would have liked to be that Pope. They have the Brazil 2014 World Cup and the Olympics, so I think it's enough. But let me tell you as well, as an exclusive, that last night when all the Latin American embassies were celebrating the opening of Latia, which is Investment Week of Latin America in London, we were at the Brazilian embassy. So I was there with my Twitter, and everybody started to pass the word, and it was in the middle of the speeches. So I was next to the ambassador Guajaribe from Brazil. So I was dictating him the name of the Pope. He's from Argentina. And it was a very interesting moment because the ambassador of Brazil in London announced yesterday night at the Brazilian embassy that the Pope was from Argentina. So he was very happy, very happy. And I think all the Brazilians are very happy.
You're very close to the action. So one last thing, Jorge Bergoglio, you're Rodolfo Milesi. It's a good week for Latin Americans with Italian lineage, isn't it?
Yes, I think in a way his Italian roots, his Italian families have helped him. No, I think that was some of the comments that the Argentina media have remarked. And yes, we are almost 40% in Argentina of Italians. We speak Spanish, but with an Italian accent and with an Italian attitude. And we are very proud of being Italian. If you go to Argentina, people will not say, yes, we are Spanish. Even though 45% of Argentines are Spanish, they're going to say we are Italian.
That was Rodolfo Milesi, founder of Branding Latin America. Now, in the next half hour of the programme, we'll be peeking inside the heads of the people who are building the cities of tomorrow, and we'll be finding out why the scientists at CERN may have made a world-shaking discovery, but all anyone wants to talk about is their weird choice of typeface at the press conference. David Spencer first, he's got the news headlines.
Thank you very much. Pope Francis I has sounded a warning to the Catholic Church at his first Sistine Chapel Mass with cardinals as Pope. He said the Church would become what he called a compassionate NGO without spiritual renewal. Pope Francis has also started the process of appointing key staff at the Vatican. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to announce a new government after clinching key deals to form a coalition 2 months after the election. In control of 68 of Parliament's 120 seats, the right-wing leader's new administration is expected to take office next week. France's Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius says France and Britain want an urgent European Union meeting to persuade their allies to lift the Syrian arms embargo. Fabius warned that Paris could break the embargo as the situation worsens in Syria. The embargo will lapse on May the 31st unless all 27 EU states agree to renew it. Brazilian dock workers have postponed a 24-hour nationwide strike planned for next week to allow more time for negotiations. Unions are unhappy at a proposed overhaul of Brazil's 1993 port regulations. Scientists who last summer triumphantly announced the discovery of a new particle but held back from saying what it was have declared there is now little doubt it was the long-sought Higgs boson. Latest analysis of data from the Large Hadron Collider particle accelerator strongly indicates it is the Higgs, say physicists. And Swiss International Airlines, part of the Lufthansa Group, has announced a 31% fall in operating profits to 212 million Swiss francs. The airlines also announced it's phasing out its Airbus A340 fleet from 2016, and orders have been placed with Boeing for 6 777-300ERs. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. You're listening to Midori House. Now, debt ceilings, fiscal cliffs, spending cuts and tax rises. The US electorate hasn't exactly been offered a very varied political diet since November, and increasingly the signs have been that citizens are starting to feel a bit sick. So yesterday marked the beginning of President Obama's aisle-crossing charm offensive, talking face-to-face with the GOP, a set of open talks which it's hoped could introduce a few new ingredients to the Capitol Hill kitchen. Any signs of movement then? Well, our editor Santiago Tarditi is in New York, where he's readying himself to take over our bureau there, but he's managed to take a sniff of what's cooking in DC too, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, Santiago. How are you?
Hi, Dom. I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. Nice to have you with us on Midori House. So I can't avoid the Pope analogy. Let's try and run with it. Two meetings, lots of people sitting together trying to rise above politics and make a big decision for the public good. Is the comparison valid in the case of Capitol Hill?
I think it is, yes. In fact, after this meeting that was held yesterday in Capitol Hill, both President Obama and the Republicans left with a positive attitude. They thought that this initial approach was very productive. And it seems that the differences were somewhat smoothened after this first meeting.
And those differences have been really pronounced. We'll talk about that in a second. But it's been sort of very clearly labelled, this, as Obama's charm offensive, the emphasis being on the personal touch. How has this sort of touchy-feely approach gone down on both sides of the aisle?
Yeah, so I think there have been two main reactions. He has received both support and criticism from his own party and from the Republicans as well. The Republicans, half of the Republicans can think of this as moving in the right direction, as being able to interact with the president and voice their concerns over what he's planning to do to reduce the deficit, the state of the entitlement programs, Medicare, Social Security. But there are other Republican representatives like Paul Ryan, who was Romney's running VP last year, who thinks that this is a suspicious move, by Obama's team. Is it a way of and getting more support, increasing his popularity, raising the polls in Obama's favor, or is it a sincere approach? And one of the reactions I thought was quite interesting and quite funny, in fact, came from the Republican congressman, Cory Gardner from Colorado, who literally said that he wasn't expecting to be doing the Harlem Shake with Obama anytime soon.
He's in touch with the kids, that guy, isn't he? I mean, we were talking a bit about the deficit there. I mean, one of the phrases that's been bandied around in sort of criticism from both sides for Obama is that there's a bit of a trust deficit, that sort of sense of possible insincerity that's detected from Republicans could be a problem. Has he helped lessen this at all?
Well, there is in fact an underlying problem, and it's the historical difference between both parties, and pretty much the Republicans want to balance the budget through creating a cut that includes abolishing Obama's healthcare overhaul, and of course Obama wants to empower the economy in different ways, by increasing the taxes to the wealthy, to the businesses. So there is still that major difference between both parties, but I think again it's positive. It's a positive start. It's the first meeting of this kind in almost 2 years after the election, and it seems that Both parties are at least willing to be open to discuss new possibilities that will benefit the American people.
Okay, Santiago, just before you go, you're moving into our bureau. You're taking it over in New York City. How's the move been going?
Well, I've been flat hunting, which is quite painful.
Yes, I bet it is.
My major debate is whether I should live in Manhattan or in Brooklyn.
Oh, you're risking being a B&T. Very dangerous stuff. Well, good luck with the search. That is quite a job, certainly in Manhattan. That's our future New York Bureau Chief Editor, Santiago Tarditi. And we're going to head to Cannes next to talk with Sophie Grove.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan, turning the tide, on Monocle.com.
You are listening to Midori House, where it's 39 minutes past 6 here in London, 39 minutes past 4 in Brisbane, Australia. Now, property developers, urban tycoons, architects, they're all flocking to the remote location in Cannes to squeeze out the last deals from the 4-day international real estate event, MIPIM, which is coming to a close tomorrow. Now, around 7,000 companies from 83 countries attend the annual event's 24th edition. Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, has been there all week for us, and she's been talking to one of the panellists at MIPIM's Innovation Forum, Kasper Guldanger-Jorgensen, who's a partner in 3XN and director of GXN, the innovation unit. Here's what he had to say to her.
So, Kasper, we're here by the crashing waves on a wonderful jetty in Cannes. Rather a blissful place to be. Sun is shining, you've just arrived, and it's your first time at MIPIM. A brave man. What are your first impressions?
Well, beside this wonderful setting, I really like that kind of subtitles, the world real estate market. So, I see a lot of people in suits and think there's a lot of business going on. So I've heard a lot about MIPIM, and I'm actually quite excited to dive in.
It's sort of raw commerce going on out there. You can spot the architects from about 4 miles away. I could tell you were you when you walked up. There's almost a divide between architects and developers. Do you feel that?
You can certainly see who's who. But we're here actually to kind of make connections and make good friendships and good collaborations. So I think I'm looking for synergy between developers and architects, engineers and other players from the building industry.
Is this something you think MIPIN is getting right, in a sense, this holistic view, trying to bring these parties together rather than having this separation between the artists, the kind of creative talent of the architects, and then the money? Is this something you think more architects are going to get on board with in the future?
For sure. I really believe in synergy between, of course, developers and architects, but as much also other fields of industries to enrich architecture and the built environment. So that's what we do in 3XN and in GXN, the innovation unit I'm running. We're really trying to embracing diversity and bringing in knowledge from a lot of different fields. And that knowledge can as well come from developers to focus on new solutions in sustainable architecture. I could mention the circular economy, trying to make new kind of revenue identifications in buildings.
We should say they're now warming up where we are for a bit of a jazz number. Later they're having the MIPIM Awards. Tell me a little bit about your practice. You're talking about sustainability here in the Copenhagen Pavilion. You're doing a little talk. Do you think that this is something that the Danish are really bringing to the table? It's something that's being discussed more and more at events like MIPIM. And what's your view and your specific angle on sustainability as a practice?
Well, yes, I think focusing on kind of human behavior, I would always put the users of the buildings first and creating the settings for whatever learning space or working environment or public functions of a building could have. It's always about creating the right frames. So to us, sustainability is very much about keeping people in focus. Doing that, we are working a lot about architectural psychology, how you actually are stimulating knowledge sharing, how you can also work with the indoor climate to create healthy spaces filled with, of course, daylight, but also be sure that the materials we're using is actually supporting a good indoor climate. So in that aspect, we are kind of bringing together both kind of behavioral knowledge, but also a lot of material science, and obviously a lot about energy performance in buildings. But it's all kind of an integrated sustainable strategy we are carrying out at 3XN.
And tell me about any exciting projects you have on the horizon as a practice.
We're actually doing a conference center and a hotel where we are eliminating the concept of waste. So thinking about waste and pollution, I would say they are man-made phenomena. And we like to kind of inspire by natural ecosystem to see how can we as architects, how can we in the building industry actually turn this kind of, you could say, a negative agenda on just minimizing environmental impact into something positive. How can we actually create buildings that are built with materials that can enter new uses? How can we create buildings that are producing energy and actually cleaning the air and also integrating nature, seeing nature as a part of a building? How can we stimulate biodiversity and the life of wild plant species and birds, insects? So it's actually quite holistical, but eliminating the concept of waste, that's what we're doing right now in one of our recent ongoing projects.
The birds and the bees. But also, can you tell me what you've seen at MIPIM that you do think is really worthwhile? What's caught your interest and you think, you know, is really sort of setting the tone for the next wave of development, which is clearly happening in Turkey and Russia? They're all there in their stalls.
I'm quite excited about this kind of global coming together. And also I see us as a practice working internationally with a lot of different cultures, and that's super enriching for us in our practice. Currently we are working in India, for example, and we see that as a very interesting market. Also bringing our building knowledge and building culture together with Indian craftsmanship and local materials, and actually trying to, whenever we engage with new cultures and new building industries, actually to create a synergy between their knowledge and what we can bring to the table with our experience.
Kasper Guldager Jorgensen there, talking to Sophie Grove. I'm delighted to say Sophie is on the phone now and I can talk to her. How are you, Sophie?
I'm fantastic, thank you. How are you?
Yes, I'm excellent, thanks. You are going to be coming back to Midori House soon, I hope. What new knowledge are you going to be bringing with you from the world of MIPIM?
Well, this is a fantastic sort of jamboree of different countries, but really the most interesting present is Turkey. And they've really been dominating everything, really. They're the country of honour. People have been eating baklava and drinking Turkish coffee and looking at the incredible amount of development that's going on there. Really interesting to see how Istanbul is emerging. We also just spoke to the mayor of Toulouse about an incredible regeneration program that he's overseeing. Some really wonderful developments even happening in Nice and the Nice area. A project of national importance is taking place. They're going to be opening a new incredible stadium, hosting the Francophone Games later in the summer. So there's so many projects that are just about to really come to fruition, which is exciting. These aren't really pie-in-the-sky models thinking, oh, you know, we might see something along the line. It really is just about to happen. So I'm quite excited to go back and find out more.
So right on the cutting edge of things there, Sophie. Thank you very much. And we'll see you back in Midori House soon. Sophie Grove, our senior editor there. Very shortly, we're going to be speaking to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. You're back with Midori House, where the time is 18:47 here in London. Now, the last time we checked in on him, he was in Frankfurt at the ISH, the International Sanitary and Heating Fair. But thanks to the very efficient rails of the Deutsche Bahn, he's traded in Frankfurt's Messe for the streets of Mitte in the German capital. Our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, just arrived in Berlin, where he's on both a print and a radio mission. And he joins us now on the line from somewhere high above Torstrasse. Tyler, how's the view?
The view is very nice. It's, the lights are twinkling, and of course the sun is down, though, in Berlin. Daylight savings time not quite kicked in here yet.
Okay, you've been on rails, but let's head up into the sky, or perhaps stay in the sky for you. Lufthansa, we've been hearing about it in the news, a big purchase.
Indeed. We had it on the bulletin earlier, at least one part of the Lufthansa group, which is Swiss International Airlines, bringing a bit of a brighter news for Boeing. They are going to be trading in, or perhaps even scrapping their A340s, and they've purchased and announced it. They're purchasing 6 777s, ERs, which of course probably really seen as the flagship aircraft for Boeing at the moment, given all the problems they're having with the 787 right now. And this is a major win for Boeing because they've never been able to crack the Lufthansa group with this particular aircraft. So I think there's probably a lot of happy faces in Seattle. But what's interesting, though, as well, is that the bigger winner in all of this, though, is Airbus. They're going to be purchasing 100 A320s, both old generation, but also what are termed the A320neos as well. So 100 of those aircraft coming in, and another 2 A380s for the mix. So people weren't just buying toilets this week at the sanitation show in Frankfurt. They were also buying aircraft.
Well, that's a relief. Christoph Franz, the top dog at Lufthansa, whistled a sort of fairly familiar tune that his strategy isn't about expansion, but about modernization, greater fuel efficiency. I guess we've heard that sort of broad tune before. Was there any sort of big surprise in this announcement? And might we see it in the other wing of the Lufthansa group as well?
Well, I think that, as you said, it's the same management line, and you could just pretty much sort of insert any other sector. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about automotive today, or you're even talking about media for that matter. We hear the same sort of lines. I think the interesting thing about this move as well, it's a confident move. Of course, they're looking for efficiency with these aircraft, and at Lufthansa, they want to be seen as a player and one of the key European players right now, particularly in a market which is in real disarray, because you've seen the breakup of the great alliance between British Airways and Qantas. And I think one of the interesting things about all of this right now is that there's such a huge question mark about everyone's air miles and these alliances, and Lufthansa sits, of course, really at the heart of Star Alliance. And a lot of people, I think, right now are saying, our alliance is going to be relevant when you've seen Qantas and an Emirates tie-up, for example, and you know, in Qantas doing probably a lot of damage to the One World Alliance. So, you know, from a Lufthansa point of view, they want to say that, you know, we're here, we're a big, incredible player, and of course, we'll continue to be a significant operator on the world stage.
Tyler, if we can talk about another subject, which we've already touched on today. We've been talking papal perception and how brand Argentina might be affected by Pope Francis, as he's now called. What's been the sort of media reaction in Germany? I can say here in London, I was relatively surprised that it wasn't necessarily a sort of full page spreads in the media here. How's it been in Germany?
Well, I think certainly all of the presses were on standby until very late last night, and I don't think one German newspaper missed really full-page coverage, and that, I think that's been the surprising thing. When I was getting on the train at Frankfurt Hauptbahnhof earlier, it was amazing looking at all of the covers, and of course, you know, Germany is a big newspaper company, a country, you know, with a number of really significant regional players. But you know, whether it's sort of looking at let's say the papers that are more national, whether it's the Frankfurter Allgemeine or the Bildzeitung, you know, all of them had the Papst spread across their front pages, and I think we become very obsessed with English language broadcast media, but it was amazing last night watching between the football, the various German networks, having all of their correspondents and just an array of correspondents, the money that the German networks, and these are the news divisions, not just the 24-hour news channels here, were spending on this coverage. And you'd sort of think of, you know, a traditional state broadcaster maybe having, you know, one person on the ground in Rome, but this is really treated as a big live event, which was probably not the same thing that one would have seen in the UK or elsewhere in the States.
Yeah, I wonder how much the fact that the outgoing man was a German had to do with that. But looking at the Monocle 24 schedule, I've had a little peek, and there's a Germany-themed special stack this weekend, is there not?
Well, there is. I mean, hopefully you would have noticed as well that there's also a German issue, still hanging on the office, though I do believe that we're very lucky that we also have the next issue is also in the office as well. So, indeed, tomorrow we are going to be recording, because oftentimes we are live doing the stack, but we will be recording in Berlin tomorrow at Do You Read Me, which really has to be one of the best magazine stores, if not in Europe, probably the world. And so we'll be talking to Mark Kiesling. He's going to be joining me on the show. He's one of the founders of Do You Read Me, and Robert Clanton, who is the Gestalten, of course, one of the biggest and most interesting book publishers, certainly on the art side in Germany. One of our collaborators who we're working with to do our Monocle book as well. So they'll be our guests this Saturday.
There we go. Tyler, thank you very much for joining us. That's our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, in Berlin. And as he was saying, you can hear a special German-themed edition of The Stack this Saturday at 1800 Hong Kong time, or 10 a.m. if you're in London.
Von out London, dit is Monocle 24.
Wei yu London, this is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Dominic Reynolds. Now, listen up at the back there. There's been a new development in the vast tunnel under Central Europe in the search for the Higgs boson, and it was unveiled by CERN scientists in a way, though, that's drawn heckles from around the world. We'll come to the presentational eccentricities of the world's smartest people in a second, but first, let's find out exactly what it is they needed to tell us all about. Gosh, it is complicated, isn't it? Earlier, I spoke to Mark Champkins, inventor in residence at the Science Museum in London, to find out more. Mark, CERN finally came out with something last year. Everyone was expecting what CERN would come up with is a definitive yes, we found it, or no, we haven't. That didn't quite happen, but what's happened now?
Well, yes, you're right. It's frustrating that they don't seem to give you a straight answer, these physicists, but it's because of the kind of element of doubt. So last year they were testing for the Higgs boson, and they were looking for a particular weight of particle in the accelerator. And they found something with what's called 5 sigma degree of certainty. So statistically, it means that they believed their tests were accurate to about 1 in 3.5 million times. So they were reasonably sure that the tests were accurate, and they were reasonably sure they saw something in the right area having the right weight to be a Higgs boson. So to that degree of certainty, they announce the results. Now, what they've discovered this time round is they've got 2.5 times the amount of data that they had last summer, and they can be that much more certain by using that data. But they've also found another property of the supposed Higgs particle that goes slightly further to verifying whether it's actually there or not.
That was Mark Champkin's Inventor in Residence. What a great title at the Science Museum, speaking to me before the show. But perhaps for all the wrong reasons, the thing everyone's been talking about isn't Higgs, but Comic Sans. Joining me now in the studio to discuss Comic Sans is Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, who's going to bring his very specific cultural weight to the discussion. Rob, explain, what's the problem with Comic Sans? What did they do with it, for a start?
The Higgs boson itself is a difficult thing to get our heads around. So they've discovered a particle. They're kind of as yet going to tell us whether or not it is the Higgs boson, etc. So there's this great kind of big kind of scientific play going on. But they chose to unveil the bit that they did unveil, this grand reveal, in Comic Sans, which is a typeface that you and I will know, people will know at the moment, famously, because there's a Roy Lichtenstein retrospective at the Tate Modern. It's that typeface that he used, those comic books used,
yes,
for those famous works and all the famous, you know, Spider-Man, Batman, all those comics going back. So it's a typeface that has been described by Errol Morris, who's a New York Times columnist, as a typeface that can't help but instill in people contempt and summary dismissal. That's a quote. So it's a weird thing.
Is it that it feels a bit patronising? When I see something written in that, I feel like someone's talking down to me.
Yeah, it's a bit like that. It is a bit like, now here you go,
there
Dom,
you go.
This is science.
You can't handle, you know, TNR.
It is a bit. It's naff. I mean, I think the greatest thing that you can level against Comic Sans typeface is it's very naff. It was a typeface that's been designed, as I say, it harks back to these comic books, the classic comic book era. It was designed by a guy called Vincent Conari, who's an in-house Microsoft font designer in 1994 as some sort of part of Windows, whatever, yes, 94 in those days. And ever since then, there are millions of blogs, thousands at least, of blogs dedicated to hating it.
They certainly do. It takes me back to sort of town hall meetings in 1997, personally. Yeah, so not perfect for
some. It's very inkjet.
It is indeed. Yeah. Our culture editor, Robert Bound, thank you very much for joining us. Sadly, that's all we have time for today. Our producer was Phil Hahn. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Chris Fitch had his hand on the faders as studio manager in 3 hours' time, 2200 hours here in London. Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson are here for The Daily.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.